Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls. We have with us tonight Victor Thorne and Lisa Giuliani, and we're going to be talking about their book, 9/11 on Trial, The World Trade Center Collapse. Now, a lot of people don't like to think about what happened that day. It's not a very nice thing. It was a terrible tragedy. It had a terrible emotional impact on every single one of us. And yet, of course, that was the watershed event that led us into a war in the Middle East. First, an attack on Afghanistan to capture Osama bin Laden, and then they wouldn't allow our troops to try to get him. We cover that in several things. We have articles out of the Washington Times saying, by high officials saying, we're not going to try to get Osama bin Laden. How would we justify the war if we got them? If you'd like to see that article, you give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, and we'll send it to you. We have another book that was actually published by a major publisher, but they refused to try to market the book, called Crude Politics, where they interviewed people coming back, the troops coming back from Afghanistan, who said, we weren't allowed to try to get Osama bin Laden. I wonder if that's why the publisher refused to try to really distribute the book. Under any circumstances, we have to go back to what happened on 9/11, and that's why Victor Thorne and Lisa are with us. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having us on.
All right, fine. So, Victor, are you there?
Yep, I'm here.
All right, and Lisa, you're there.
Yes, sir.
All right, fine. Well, tell us a little bit about yourself. How did it happen that you got involved in trying to let the American people know what really happened that day?
Well, I've been studying this subject, not 9/11, but the subject of the New World Order at large for about 15 years now. And, you know, after 9/11 happened, we were running an online magazine at the time, and we're one of the first publishers in the country that started running 9/11 skeptics information. So really for the last 3.5 years we've been compiling information, looking at this whole scenario, and finally late last year started working on this book and really putting it together and came out with it in February of this year.
No, well, I think there's some fascinating things that you bring out. You know, we're told, oh, this flaming inferno, but we can all remember seeing the picture of the blonde woman standing there in the North Tower, and she's standing right where the hole is. If it's a blazing inferno, how can she possibly be just simply standing there looking out?
Right, that was supposed to be the hottest point, the impact zone.
Right, and of course then they point out that the black smoke, you know, reflects the fact that this is a smoldering fire, not a hot fire. And then, of course, the audio tapes from the firefighters who actually got to the levels of where the impact was, and the fires were not intense at all. They thought they could put them out. And then the way everything has been covered up, the way they won't let us hear those tapes. How did you get hold of the copies of the tapes, the audio tapes? Hold on just a moment, because we're going to have to soon to take a quick break here, and then we'll be right back in just a moment with Victor Thorne and Lisa Giuliani, and we're going to be talking about their book, 9/11 on Trial. Okay, fine. Lisa, am I pronouncing your name right? Lisa, am I pronouncing your name right? Is it Giuliani?
Huh?
Lisa, am I pronouncing your name correctly?
It's Lisa Giuliani.
Giuliani.
No, that's what I thought. Rudy Giuliani.
Like your father, the mayor?
Yeah. Like my sister, the mayor. Yeah.
Like your sister, the mayor. Okay. All right, fine. Well, anyway, of course, let's just talk a little bit about, you know, some of the material you have. You actually quote from the audio tapes that were taken. Those have been pretty well suppressed. How did somebody get hold of those? Because the government didn't want the people to know that the firefighters were up on the floor where the impact occurred, and they didn't seem to think the fires were very bad.
Well, other researchers on the internet have actually been able to get a hold of those transcripts, and so they are available, I believe, on the internet. And they had reached the 78th floor of the South Tower.
Yeah,
what, they take it from there.
Yeah, what this book really is a compilation of research, and we quoted 40, almost 50 different sources here. So it's really the best of the best research that's been done in this 9/11 field, and this includes not only the audio tapes from the firefighters, but every other area, from the collapse of the towers to the exploding concrete. So what we've done is just culminated everything together and packed into about 170 pages or so, and the final result is 9/11 on trial.
All right. Well, it's a fascinating book, and I've certainly enjoyed reading it. And we were just talking about, of course, the transcripts of the audio tapes of the firefighters. And I think the most significant thing is everything seems to be cover-up. My impression was of why they did not want the public to know what those firefighters were really saying. Would that be a fair estimate, a fair evaluation of what happened?
Well, when you started the show, you mentioned something about truth. An illusion, and it brought to mind a quote that John Kennedy gave, and I'm sure you've heard this, Mr. Monteith, but he said, the great enemy of truth is very often not the lie, which is deliberate and contrived and dishonest, but the myth, which is persistent and persuasive and unrealistic. And I thought that was so apropos because about a week and a half ago, our local newspaper actually allowed me to run an op-ed piece about this book, a 650-page article. And I,
650 word.
Or 600, I'm sorry, 650 word article. And now the responses to this letter to the editor are appearing, and the illusions that people are under in regard to 9/11 are fantastic. Like one woman today.
Now hold that thought for just a moment, because we're going to bring our other stations right back on with us, and I want people to hear what you have to say. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess it's evening of Victor Thorne and Lisa Giuliani. And, of course, they were pointing out that some of the investigators there actually got hold of the transcripts of the radio messages that were broadcast from the inside of the World Trade Center by the people, by the firemen and the fire chief that had actually gotten up to the level of the impact in the South Tower, saying that the fires were well under control and that they could just, you know, with a little water, they could put those fires out. There was no intense fire. There was no flaming inferno. There was nothing there that was hot enough to melt the beams. And then Victor was saying he had recently written a 650-page op-ed piece for his local newspaper, and, of course, the replies that came in from the American people, whose reality has been shaped by the mass media, by the Rush Limbaughs and Sean Hannitys and Bill O'Reillys and Dan Rathers and Brian McCall or Brian Williams, or, you know, the whole thing, they shape what we believe. And by repetition over and over again, if everybody's saying it, why, it must be true. The king is well-dressed, even though the king doesn't wear any clothes. So Victor was about to tell us some of the responses he's gotten to his op-ed piece. Go ahead, Victor.
So anyway, I listed a lot of facts and figures that we have found through this research, and one of them, one of the most vital pieces of information, was that the fires within the towers on the morning of 9/11 never reached above the 500 to 600 degree level. Well, this woman that wrote back the response to this op-ed piece, she said that the temperatures in the towers, she said you have to actually add a zero to those figures. So according to her now, the temperatures in the towers were up to the 5,000 to 6,000 degree range. And, you know, to get molten steel in a liquefied state, you need a temperature of like 5,182 degrees. So she said it was even hotter than that inside the towers.
Now, how did she know that?
Well, that's funny you ask, because she said that she read this and she believes this. That was all that it was based upon.
But you see, Victor, we believe what we want to believe. And I know very well, I've been in that position, because sometimes to face the reality of what's really going on is beyond our ability. In fact, for many years I was involved in the effort to try to address the AIDS epidemic from a public health point of view and save human lives. And one of my friends, Dr. Lorraine Day, kept telling me, this is all population control. Don't you understand? That's why every effort to try to use standard public health techniques and save human lives is being blocked. And I didn't want to believe that. So I refused to believe it, even though today, of course, it's very obvious I was wrong and she was right. But it takes, well, it's hard sometimes to, admit you've made a mistake. And unfortunately, they've done a great job with the reality of the American people. I thought one of the most interesting things in your book was your description of the fact that the top of the South Tower had actually tipped, and it was beginning to fall off, and then it began disintegrating right there. It didn't collapse, as we're told, the pancake effect, but it had tipped about 23 degrees and should have simply fallen off and not then come down on the rest of the building. Why don't you tell that story? Because I think that is so vitally important, because I've seen those pictures as the top tilts, and the question is, why didn't it keep tilting and just fall off, and then the rest of the building would have stood up?
Right. What it did was it tilted 23 degrees past vertical, and it should have continued toppling in the same direction, but something independent had to occur to reverse the direction that it was tipping, so it could fall vertically into its own footprint. Now, this defies Newton's law, first law of motion. So it should have continued toppling over and landed on the sidewalk next to the rest of the structure, but it didn't. You know, and the government wants us to believe that, you know, this implausible scenario actually occurred when it's impossible that it could have.
And I think that really is so important. And then you pointed out that this was the top floors were beginning to sort of disintegrate. They weren't actually pancaking down. They were beginning to disintegrate as it was tilting. And then, of course, the rest of the building begins to implode.
Yeah, if they had pancaked, they would have just had a free ride all the way to the ground.
But something happens. And those of you who haven't seen the Eric Hufschmidt's book, where he has these pictures, and you can actually see that top tilting, but you know, that is something that has never been shown. If it was shown on television, it was gone over so quickly and then never shown again. Because the last thing they want is for American people to question what we've been told, the official party line, as it were. Well, what were some of the other things that you learned as you began to evaluate this, either Lisa or Eric, or Lisa or Victor?
Well, there's one of the biggest things is the actual speed upon which these towers collapsed into the ground. That's the most amazing thing. And even when you talk to skeptics, say someone that's real familiar in the sciences or whatever, you start talking to them about this, and they're like, oh, no, that's all conspiracy theory. And, you know, I'll say, well, what field are you in? And if they're in physics or science or whatever, I say, well, how can you explain the fact that these 1,350 or 1,360-foot towers came to the ground in somewhere between 10 to 11 seconds? And I mentioned then this formula, which is T equals the square root of 2H divided by G. And I say, I'm sure you're familiar with that formula, aren't you? And they're like, well, of course I am. I says, then tell me how there can be virtually no resistance whatsoever as these towers came to the ground. And they start scratching their head, and you can see the wheels in their mind spinning. And then they say, I don't have an answer for that. I'm going to have to look into it. And that's the thing that really plants the seed is we wanted to stay away from conspiracy theory in this book. Mm-hmm. And that's what we did. Instead, we, you know, used physics and math and scientific equations and so forth to prove all of the points. And
virtually the only resistance that these floors met was air resistance.
And I think what was really so interesting is, of course, there were certainly reinforcing steel that were separating these, and of course there would have been at least some resistance, even if the pancake theory was accurate. There would have been enough resistance to have held it up for a few seconds at each floor. but there was absolutely no resistance there. And it just simply crumbled on itself, as if something had happened that had removed any support or any strength in that building.
Yes. Well, for your listeners out there, just let me throw a few numbers at them to convey the magnitude of how large these structures were. There were 200,000 tons of steel in each building. There were 425,000 cubic yards of concrete, and each tower weighed 1 billion pounds. That's 500,000 tons. Plus, there were all the desks and chairs and computers and cabinets and so forth. Yet there was absolutely no resistance when they fell to the ground. It just defies logic, literally, that something like this could have happened the way the government says that it did.
Well, I think the most interesting thing is the government would not allow any sort of investigation. The government would not allow independent investigators to go in. The government would not allow any of the independent investigators to examine the steel independently. And certainly this was the greatest, catastrophe as far as construction is concerned. Why, you would think that the architects, the engineers, would have wanted to know why the building failed. But for
right.
one reason or another, the government wouldn't allow them to evaluate that. Isn't that accurate?
Yes, they tampered with a major crime scene and only examined 80 pieces of the steel.
And the other thing was that this was the greatest catastrophe as far as the fire department was concerned.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to know why those buildings had failed so to protect their firefighters in the future. And there was an organized, orchestrated effort on the part of the Bush administration to prevent a thorough investigation. Now, why would they block that? You would think that they would want to know so that would not happen again.
Well, there's a gentleman named Bill Manning, who's the editor of the oldest firefighting magazine in the country. It's 125 years old. And he said that this was the largest loss of firefighters ever in one incident. He said the second largest loss of life on American soil ever, the first total collapse of a high-rise during a fire, and the largest structural collapses in history. He says not only just for the life that was lost, but the way buildings are constructed and the way insurance companies insure them, and on and on and on. He says we should be doing everything in our power, yet there was only $600,000 spent in total on this whole, I would just say, quote-unquote investigation, because I don't consider it any type of investigation whatsoever. And as Lisa said, out of the 185,000 tons of steel that was taken from Ground Zero, only 80 pieces of steel were looked at, and they weren't even checked to see if any type of explosives were used
right.
on the morning of 9/11. So it's a sham, it's a scam, and it's really just everything all of us should be embarrassed about.
And we always point out, Dr. Monteith, that before 9/11, no steel-reinforced structure ever totally collapsed due to fire in history. Yet on 9/11, three structures did on the same day, controlled by the same group, within hours of each other.
And I think it's so important, controlled by the same group. You pointed out the investigation. The same man investigated what happened at Waco, and who investigated what happened at Oklahoma City, the Oklahoma City bombing, and then, of course, the World Trade Center. You would think they would have gotten an independent individual in there. Certainly we know the government lied about Waco, because he ended up paying Randy Weaver and his family over $3 million. So the government lied about what happened there. But we've never had an independent examination of what happened at Oklahoma City or at 9/11. And the very man who had apparently, according to your book, and I was fascinated by that, who had actually been commissioned by the government to investigate Waco and Oklahoma City, was called in to investigate what happened structurally there at the World Trade Center. Did that bother you?
Well, yeah, the gentleman's name is Dr. W. Gene Corley, and you're exactly right. He went from Waco to Oklahoma City to 9/11, plus, even more coincidentally, if you want to say it that way, that the same company that carried away the wreckage in Oklahoma City carried it away from Ground Zero on 9/11, and that was a place called Controlled Demolition Incorporated. So they keep it, as they say, in the family.
We'll have to be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guests this evening, Victor Thorne and Lisa Giuliani of and their book is 9/11 on Trial, The World Trade Center Collapse. And this is a fascinating book. It points out, of course, you'll all remember the black smoke. But what was the real significance of the black smoke? Why did we see black smoke instead of an awful lot of flames? Certainly we saw some flames, but not an awful lot of flames there, at least not after the initial explosion, you know, when, of course, so much of the fuel exploded outside the South Tower. Now, we didn't see what had really happened in the North Tower until the next day, and there was not that great an explosion when the plane hit the building, but there certainly was a massive explosion when the plane hit the South Tower. What was the difference? Why did we see that great fireball there in the South Tower? And why does that play such an important part in evaluating what happened?
What people need to understand is that all jet fuel is refined kerosene, and it will burn off within a few minutes. Okay? So what we saw with the South Tower, most of that fuel splashed outside of the building, and that was the intense fireball that we saw. But after the initial fireballs, the smoke was thick black plumes coming from the buildings. And that's indicative of an oxygen-starved or suffocating fire. Those fires were going out within minutes.
That's because when you have a well-burning fire, why, of course, you see the flames. If you have an oxygen-starved fire, you see black smoke. Is that fairly accurate appraisal?
And the reason we saw that big fireball when the South Tower was hit, that's the second tower, was because of the angle that the airplane hit the tower. It hit right on the corner of it, so approximately 90% of the fuel or the jet fuel splashed outside of the building, and that's what, as Lisa said, that's that big fireball you see. But if you remember that this tower was hit 16 and a half minutes after the first tower, okay? Now, when you see the videotapes of them, look very closely, and you'll see that the first tower, the North Tower, is already emitting black smoke from it. So just in the span of about 15 minutes, this fire has been virtually extinguished, except for some localized fires, and it's already emitting the black smoke, which means, as you said, that it's an oxygen-starved fire, and it's dwindling, it's going out.
And I thought that that was really such an important part of the story. That, and of course, the blonde woman standing there in the hole created by the plane, and we've seen pictures of her standing there. And of course, she cannot be standing there if this is this flaming inferno, we're told. You know, my goodness, 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Why, she would have been incinerated. Yet then she's just standing there, almost calmly looking out, you know, through this hole there, that, you know, at what's transpiring. Then, of course, another place you have a letter from some gentleman who's working for an underwriting group. Do you want to cover that? I thought that was a fascinating letter. And who is he writing to? And, of course, this man is basically saying, look, there's no way that steel could have melted. And this man certainly knows metallurgy, doesn't he?
Right.
Yes, he does.
Yeah, well, the gentleman's name is Kevin Ryan. And if anyone would like to actually see what we're talking about come alive, they can go to www.wingtv.net. And as a matter of fact, Lisa just did the testimony for this gentleman on our TV. We're bringing the book to life on our TV show, and we strongly urge everyone to tune in and watch it because they can really see for themselves then. But I'll let her explain what happened with Kevin Ryan.
Well, I tell you what, before we do that, Lisa, we're going to have to bring our stations back on board here in about 8 seconds. So I want our people to actually hear what you have to say about Kevin Ryan. So just hold that thought for just one moment here. Well, once again, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. We're talking about what happened on 9/11. And people say, I don't want to hear about it. I don't want to think about it. Well, you've got to think about it. Because, of course, what happened on 9/11 brought us into what I believe is World War III. We've already lost over 1,500 men killed just in Iraq alone. We don't ever like to talk about all those people killed in Afghanistan and all the people injured. And we never want to talk about the civilians that are getting killed over there. Some estimates up to 100,000. Just like with Vietnam, we talk about the 58,000 American boys who died, and that's a terrible tragedy. But why don't we ever talk about the million South Vietnamese and the 2 million North Vietnamese? Well, we were drawn into World War I, at least in part, by a contrived incident. The Germans had said they were going to sink a passenger ship called the Lusitania, And the American State Department told the passengers, go ahead, there's nothing to worry about, the Lusitania is not going to go down, knowing full well that the Lusitania would go down and that the British Admiralty would actually pull away the destroyer escort, so they could be assured the ship would go down, and 1,200 people lost their lives. And that was one of the things that was used later on to bring America into the war, and 21 million people died. 21 million people died. Pearl Harbor got America into the Second World War, and 40 to 60 million people died. Of the Gulf of Tonkin incident, which didn't occur, got us into the Vietnam War, and 3 million Vietnamese died, as well as 58,000 Americans died. What happened on 9/11 is drawing us into World War III. How many countless tens, if not hundreds of millions, will die in this terrible conflict that lies ahead? We have to understand what happened on 9/11. So, Victor, go ahead and pick. I guess Lisa, you were going to tell us what this was about. What was this about, Mr. Ryan, and what he had said?
This is a gentleman, Kevin Ryan. He was the site manager for a company called Underwriters Laboratories. This company was overseeing the certification of the steel components of the World Trade Center towers during their construction. And the steel met all the specifications that was required of it. Okay, so he wrote a letter to a Dr. Frank Gale of the National Institute of Standards and Technologies because he wanted to get the record straight that jet fuel cannot burn hot enough to melt steel. And he wanted Dr. Gale to set everyone straight on that because apparently it's believed that much lower temperatures cause the steel to melt. But in order for steel to melt, it would have to reach a temperature of 2,795 degrees. For it to become molten, it would have to reach its boiling point, which is 5,182 degrees. Now, the maximum temperature of a hydrocarbon fire is 1,517 degrees Fahrenheit. And jet fuel will only burn at approximately 1,800. So, I mean, we have a huge variance there between how hot the fire will burn and what it takes to melt steel.
And, of course, even if some of the steel did melt, you would have to melt all, 46 central heavy core structures that were holding that up, as well as, of course, the periphery. This was a very, very powerfully built building.
Right. The external casing was aluminum, and that didn't even melt.
I think that's so interesting. The aluminum didn't melt, but we're supposed to believe that the central steel core did.
Yeah.
Right, and some of them were 4 inches thick at the base. There were 47 of the steel columns plus 236 periphery columns going around it. One of the biggest illusions about this whole event is the government wants us to think that the World Trade Center towers were these weak, flimsy buildings, and just the exact opposite is true because these were some of the strongest, most vibrant, robust buildings ever made in the history of the world, and they weren't something that was just going to tumble over like some Lincoln Logs or whatever. This is one of the biggest lies they've stated about this.
But, you know, it's been said that it doesn't matter how ridiculous something is, Victor. If you say it often enough and convincingly enough and enough people say it who are accepted as authorities, why people will believe.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it's funny you mention that because earlier tonight I was watching an interview, or actually you were on a show, The Power of Prophecy, and you brought up this concept that everyone needs to remember. It's cognitive dissonance. And when you get bombarded with so much information, and especially when the information is false, it creates this unreality for us.
You're absolutely right. Reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. Well, we're going to have to take a break. When we get back, of course, we'll invite your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 464-8295. What's the telephone number people can call to get your book, or how can they get it, Victor?
Well, they can go to www.wingtv, that's WINGTV.net, wingtv.net, and if they don't...
We'll get the rest of it in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Victor Thorne and Lisa Giuliani, and we're talking about their book, 9/11 on Trial. And of course, you can go to Wings. Is it Wing or Wings TV?
Yeah, Wing TV, W-I-N-G-TV dot net.
WingTV.net. Go ahead.
And on there, they can order via PayPal, or if they're not comfortable using PayPal, also our address is on there. Just click on the cover of the book that says 9/11 on Trial, and not only will all the ordering information come up, but also the TV show that we do, all the reviews done in this book, and also there's a photo gallery that corresponds to every chapter in the book that acts as a supplement, so you can see the black smoke, or you can see the exploding concrete and so forth.
All right, fine. Well, of course, I think that, you know, one of the biggest things that should make every American question is, in no time, in any time in history, have fires brought down steel-reinforced buildings. It just doesn't happen. But let's just take for the sake of argument that what the government is telling us somehow is true. How does that explain what happened to Building 7? Because that was a classic demolition. It didn't come down from the top. It came down from the bottom. And had it not been, you know, very carefully planned, it would have tipped to one side or the other. But somebody had, obviously, explosive charges all around the periphery, equally, so that the building would sort of just collapse on itself. I mean, why did Building 7 come down? And nobody seems to want to ask that question.
Well, that's the topic they least want to talk about, because that's the one that's most fraught with danger for them, because when you look at the videotapes of this and photographs of WTC-7, you see one small little fire on the 12th floor that's so small, in fact, that you can barely see it from outside on the streets. Somebody, I think it might actually have been Eric Hupschmidt, described this fire as so small, he said, that you could actually roast marshmallows over. That's how tiny it was. But at 5:20 in the afternoon, out of nowhere, this 47-story steel structure pancaked into its own footprint to the ground, and it's absolutely ridiculous. There's no other explanation other than controlled demolition, and that's why when you bring up WTC-7 to the government or official sources, you can see them scramble away from it as quickly as possible because they have no answer.
Right, and it wasn't hit by any jetliner.
Right.
Well, of course, they claim that there was diesel fuel stored in that building. And it was stored on one of the upper floors and then down in the basement. Mayor Giuliani, your sister there, had actually, of course, built a command center in this building. Why would you build a command center with all this flammable stuff right in the building where all these people... Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Victor Thorne and, of course, Lisa Giuliani. And let's give your telephone number and your website out one more time, and then we'll go to Mike, who's calling from San Francisco, and remind our listeners out across America. The line number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295 here in the Central Coast of California. That telephone number and website one more time, Victor.
The best way to order, actually, we don't take credit card orders over the phone, but the best way to find this book is www.wingtv.net.
All right, where is that program? Where is your television program seen?
It's right on the Internet. If they go to our website, you'll see a TV set right on the site. If you click on the link above that, you'll go to the TV show. We do it every Monday through Friday. And right now, we're in the middle of filming 9/11 on Trial. So every witness in the book is brought to life in a new show that we create a show around on our TV show.
Right. Each witness represents a chapter of the book, and we present one chapter every day.
All right. Sounds like a great idea, and that's one way of getting around the media monopoly. Well, let's go to Mike calling from San Francisco. Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
Good evening, guys. Dr. Stan, thanks so much for having Victor and Lisa on. And also thank you for your continued investigation into the 9/11 hoax.
Okay, do you have a question at all?
Yeah, I'd like to find out how has been the response by the public to your book, Victor?
Oh, it's been phenomenal. We've been, without trying to blow our own horn or pat ourselves on the back, we just got... just received our third print run today, and the book's only been out for about a month and a half. So people are extremely hungry for this information, because the longer it goes and the more they research this subject, the more they know it stinks to high heaven in what the government's telling us, and they want some truth. They want some facts.
And more importantly, it disproves what some 9/11 researchers have been telling us, that the public is not ready for the truth. The public is more than ready for the truth, and the public can cope with the truth.
Right. There's a gentleman named Kyle Hentz who's up in New York City, who's with one of these 9/11 truth groups, and he actually had the audacity to say that people aren't ready for the truth about 9/11. Well, we couldn't disagree more, because we actually put a lot of faith in the American people that they do want the truth, and they're proving us right, because the feedback we get on a daily basis, you know, about this book is phenomenal.
Right, and it lets us know that people believe that truth matters today.
Okay, Mike, your job up there is to turn around San Francisco. Now, that should be pretty easy, because there are only 350,000 people there, and with you and a couple of other people, you ought to be able to get them listening to our program and get these good people to think. There's a lot of good people in San Francisco. That the trouble is, though, that they're keeping quiet and they're not involved.
Definitely, and I totally support what you guys are saying, and I do everything that I can. Every person that I talk to, I usually have to use baby spoonfuls of the truth to talk to them, to kind of get them to think a little bit outside of what the TV tells them.
Well, just remember, Mike, ask questions more than lecturing them. Okay?
Yeah, definitely. That's a good suggestion. I also picked up Victor's book. I'm about halfway through it. I think it's really great. I love the way that he goes through so thoroughly, step by step, exposing this whole crime against our country. And what I think we're seeing now is our own Bolshevik revolution. It's just that the millions of people are dying off of our soil, not on our soil.
Well, I fear, Mike, that if we don't get this thing straightened out, they may be dying here, too. So, God bless
you.
Thanks so very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Jim, who's calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Dr. Stan. I'm tuning in a little late here, so I hope I don't direct you into information you've already covered. But I wanted to ask your guests if they had any, what their opinions were about this debunking article in the Popular Mechanics this month.
Oh, that's that's a pretty infamous article, and it's been bandied about quite a bit here on different radio shows. And what we did is we actually contacted the editor of Popular Mechanics, a gentleman named Jim Meigs, and this was a day or so after his article came out. It coincided about exactly when this book came out. And I told him, I said, I'm going to put a copy of this book in the mail for you, and I want the 70 experts that you've quoted in this article. I said, I want you to go over this book with a fine-tooth comb, and if you can disprove the main thesis of this book, that the government's official version of events in regard to the collapse of the World Trade Center towers is a lie. If you can disprove what I said in this book, I said, not only will I publicly state it that you've done so, I'll pull this book off the market and I'll never sell it again. And as of now, we haven't heard a word from Popular Mechanics.
No, what they did was they addressed the weaker, less relevant peripheral conspiracies, but they didn't address the very strong theories and information that's presented in our book. And actually, we don't present any theory, we present facts.
And I think what they very often do is they set up a straw man and then they knock down the straw man, but they avoid the important issues. And, you know, I would just love to have an opportunity to debate this issue, because I would not talk about a lot of the things that might be questionable. I would talk about the things that they don't want to talk about, like, as you say, Building 7, or how could it be that those passports could have survived that flaming inferno that was so hot it would melt steel, and yet one was able to get out of the pocket of a hijacker and out of the flaming inferno of the plane and out of the flaming inferno of the building that was hot enough to melt steel and just flutter down and just land on the sidewalk there unsinged. If you believe that story, you probably believe the official government position. Jim, do you have anything else to ask?
Yes, I just wanted to comment about the Pentagon section of this article, you know, because I'm looking at these pictures here, and, you know, I'm sorry, but I just don't see a plane here. I don't know if you've seen, if any of you have looked at these pictures. I'm sure you have, but in the three pictures of the Pentagon that are shown, I just can't see where there's a 75-foot hole in the building.
All right. Well, I think that there's some very, very serious questions about that. That's another question they really don't want to debate. Any comment on that at all, Victor or Lisa?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've spoken about this quite a number of times on our TV show, and we've actually showed these pictures that the caller was referring to that, you know, you look at the lawn in front of the Pentagon minutes after this event happened, and it looks like a putting green. There's no skid marks, no burn marks, no scorch marks, no tire marks, no anything. You look at the hole, there's no hole there before the facade collapses. It's the whole thing is a charade.
And what the FBI did was say that the plane, initially they said it vaporized. Then they later contradicted themselves and said, well, actually, we've reconstructed nearly all of the jetliner, and we're storing it in an FBI hangar. Well,
but
if that's the case, they should just show up.
Unbelievable.
Well, of course, a friend of mine, Jim Mars, in his book, and he describes it as called an inside job. And there was a woman, according to Jim, and I have no reason to disbelieve him. I've never found him in a lie, who was in the Pentagon with her child. And, of course, she took a little while to come out. But she was actually able to stagger out through the hole in the side of the building. It's a fairly small hole. There was no fire there. The fire was in the upper stories, but not in the hole. And there was no wreckage. And so when she gets to the hospital, there come the men in black, telling her that she saw the plane, that she saw the fire, that she saw the remains of the crash. And she said, I didn't see it. And they said, take the money and keep your mouth shut. And,
you're right.
It.
We've interviewed Jim, I think, three different times, and you're right. He's one of the best researchers out there. And we asked him about this very same question, and he explained it just like you did. That, you know, this again, yet again, doesn't add up.
Where is Rush Limbaugh when we need him to get to the bottom of this? Anything else, Jim?
Yeah. You guys, you know the picture where it shows the burning car, right? You know the small picture. It just seems to me that from that picture, from that angle, I should be able to see a hole in the side of the building.
Well, there's a small hole.
And it's just not there.
Well, there is a small hole, I think, but...
Yeah, it's about 18 foot in diameter.
Right, about 18 foot. It's awful hard to squeeze a great big airliner through an 18 foot hole.
You bet.
Thanks so much, Jim. Let's go to Jim calling from Indianapolis. And again, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And if you believe that they could squeeze this massive airliner and the tail and the wings and all into this 18-foot hole, why, you probably believe the government story. Tim, did you have a question for our guest?
Yes, I have about three quick questions.
All right. Well, just one at a time.
Okay. Yes, Vic and Lisa, I'd like to say you two are saints. You honor these 2,900-plus people who were murdered. And for the last 3.5 years, you know, the poor Arabs, they've been attacked worldwide as the terrorists. But would you agree, look how these people can lie to our faces. Bush and Cheney and Paul and Condoleezza and Giuliani, Pataki and Charlie Schumer, they all had to know, you know, what was going down.
Well, we don't know that what they know ahead of time. You know, there's no way we can say that the president knew ahead of time. In fact, if he knew ahead of time, it would be the first time in all of history that a black operation, the CIA operation, was ever given to the president ahead of time. Because, you see, if it could ever be proven that he knew the country would fall, so certainly President Reagan was never told about Iran-Contra. He, as Admiral Poindexter said, he would like to have known about it, but we would not tell him. I don't believe that George Bush knew what was going to come down. I think that morning when he was in the schoolhouse reading the book about the goat, I think he was frightened to death. That's why he didn't get up and do anything. The whole enormity of what had happened, I think he knew something was going to happen, but I don't think he knew the details.
Right,
and we can't
prove
that he did, so we're better off just to say that somebody knew. We don't know who that is.
Right, what we say in this book, and we don't even mention George Bush's name once in this book, but what we do say is it was a small cabal within our government that planned it, executed it, coordinated it, and also was instrumental in the cover-up of it. And as Lisa said earlier, we don't go into areas that we can't pinpoint for sure. So, you know, like I said, we don't mention George Bush's name, but these people were very well aware.
But you want to know something? Considering how much he's obstructed investigation into 9/11, I would say that somewhere along the line, he found out something about it, because
he's very complicit
and,
now.
And now he is deliberately part of the cover-up.
All right. Sure. And what's Tim?
Yes. How can we not mention Larry Silverstein?
Of course.
When you discussed 9/11, why would Larry Silverstein fire Marvin? Do you know who Marvin Bush is, Victor?
Right, the president's brother.
Right, I've never heard his name mentioned in 3 years now.
Well, why don't you explain who he was? Because I think that is significant. Who is this Marvin Bush, and what is his significance?
Well, he was not only in charge of security at the World Trade Center towers, he was also in charge of security, or he's on one of the boards of security at the airports that were instrumental in this quote-unquote hijacking.
Well, now, what is his relationship to the president?
It's his brother.
It's his brother, one of them. So he's got Jeb and Neil. And so I guess they've got quite a few brothers there.
Right, right. And, you know, in regard to the Pentagon, or to Larry Silverstein, I'm sorry, you know, he said that he pulled these buildings, and Larry Silverstein, when you start looking into motive and so forth, he bought these towers for a steal, because the city of New York wanted to dump them. The Port Authority didn't want these towers anymore because they would have had to have spent billions of dollars to get all of the fiberglass out of it, the insulation out of it, so they dumped them off to Silverstein. Silverstein had a special clause written into the contract about terrorism, so when these towers came down, he made billions off of this. So when you look at it, everybody wins. The government won because they got to go to war. The Port Authority in New York City won because they dumped the building. Silverstein won because he made billions. The only people that lose are who?
The people who got killed.
Yeah, the people who got killed and the American public. We lose.
Well, one more question, Tim. We've got another caller, but do you have one more question? Oh, I guess we lost Tim, and so let's go to Willie. Hi, Willie, how are you doing?
Good, how are you doing?
Doing fine. Where are you calling from?
Kennewick, Washington.
Okay, do you have a question for us?
I was wondering if... your guests were familiar with the episode of The Lone Gunman, the spinoff of The X-Files?
I mean, it was a television program about 6 months before the 9/11 attack.
Yeah.
It described exactly what happened. Do you know that one, Victor? Did you ever see that?
Well, we very rarely watch television, but I've read about this episode and I've seen reference to it. But in all honesty, I've never even seen the X-Files.
Well, for our listeners out there, the Lone Gunman was an offshoot of the X-Files, and these were three computer nerds who were always working with Mulder, and you know, all had these great advantages. But they put them into a separate series, and 6 months before the World Trade Center attack, supposedly they were flying from Europe towards the United States. And somebody took over control of the plane. In other words, suddenly the pilot could no longer control the plane. And it was headed right for the World Trade Center. And so this dramatic episode unfurls as they have to figure out how to regain control of the plane and hack into the computer that is guiding the plane. And the plane is just about ready to hit the World Trade Center when at the last minute, they just managed to regain control of the plane, and it soars up and just soars right over the very, very top of those buildings. And it was almost prophetic, wasn't it, Willie?
If you've ever seen it, if you get the chance to see it, it's surreal after the fact, watching through the windshield of this plane, the towers, which are no longer there, coming in. You know, they just barely pull up at the last second, but you know that the real planes didn't pull up at the last second.
But of course,
they did have that same view.
But of course, the interesting thing was that a computer was able to fly the plane and direct it exactly where somebody wanted it directed.
Imagine that.
Yeah.
Okay, Willie, thanks very much.
No problem. Good night. God bless you.
Okay, God bless you too, Willie. We're just about out of time, Victor. Lisa, we got about we have a couple of minutes here. So, Victor, what are some of the other things that you'd like to talk about? What about the seismographic evidence? We haven't talked about that.
Oh, yeah, that's another one that, in the most succinct terms, I guess what we'd have to say is that there were huge spikes recorded at a place that does have seismographic
Palisades.
Palisades. And the funny part was that the spikes didn't occur when the buildings were collapsing and hitting the ground. In fact, when the biggest spikes occurred was right when the towers started to fall down. So nothing had ever even hit the ground yet, but the biggest spike occurred right then when they, at the moment they started to fall. So what would that be attributable
to? The seismic equipment recorded a 2.1 and a 2.3, and these spikes were registered at the beginnings of the collapses. The plane impacts themselves produced negligible spike, you know, negligible information on the registers.
Now, you talk about the molten metal. Was that the molten metal that was found in the sub-basement there where, of course, the girders that supported the building fastened into the rock? What was that about?
Right, that was at the base of the towers. This was 70 feet below street level, seven stories below the base of the World Trade Center towers, and there were pools of molten steel that had to have reached a temperature of over 5,000 degrees that were still bubbling 5 weeks after 9/11. How can that happen?
In an oxygen-starved environment.
Right, from fires that never reached above 500 or 600 degrees a minute or two after impact.
Well, something went on that the American people are not being told. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Is there anything else you want to say, Terry? All right, let's see who we've got. Okay, we've got Terry from Santa Cruz? Is this Steve from New York?
Hello?
Hello, who's this?
My name is Steve from New York.
All right, fine. Steve from New York, do you have a quick question?
Very quick question, yeah. And it might have already been, I just got the tail end of it, but could it not have been possible that the kerosene ignited something other with regard to the contents of the building, construction material, and so forth that caused the tremendous heat? That was my question.
All right. How would you respond to Steve, who says, wasn't there something else? Maybe the tremendous heat came from something else in the building that was burning.
Right. Well, the towers themselves were primarily steel and concrete, and FEMA itself admits in their report, they said the heat produced by the burning jet fuel did not by itself appear to have been sufficient to initiate the structural collapses. So there was a study done by the Corus Steel Construction Company and also by the Vancouver Independent Media Study, and they very painstakingly went over not only the building itself but also the contents inside of it. And both of these studies concluded that the fires could not have been over 500 or 600 degrees inside of the tower. So what you had was some chairs and carpeting and walls and so forth burning, but that's it. And it never got above 500 or 600 degrees.
And remember, the maximum temperature of a hydrocarbon fire is 1,517 degrees Fahrenheit. That's the hottest it can burn.
Yeah,
I think, Steve, one of the most significant things is the FEMA report. FEMA was actually asked to investigate this and given a few $100,000 to do it. We're going to spend $560 million on a new embassy over there in Baghdad, but they could only come up with $600,000 for the investigation. And FEMA said, we don't understand it.
Yeah.
I think that FEMA report's worthwhile getting. Hey, thanks very much for calling. Let's quickly go to Terry. Terry, do you have a quick question?
Yes, I wonder if your guests have heard about, I read about a charge that doesn't explode, but it creates an extremely high temperature. It's molded around a column or whatever the item is, and it will literally melt steel. I read that on the Cutting Edge Ministries website.
And I think that's probably true. Do you have any comment at all on that, Victor or Lisa?
Yeah, he may be referring to something like thermite or whatever.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I know of a substance called white phosphorus that can melt steel.
Yeah, and this is really the conjecture, Terry.
Right.
Is there
right.
was something that was placed at the bottom, and certainly the financial structure of that building lost its just disappeared. Hey, we've got to let you go. We're out of time. God bless. Thanks so much. And Lisa and Victor, thank you so very much. I'd like to get you back on one of our other programs. Your excellent guest, thank you so much for writing your book, 911.
Thanks, Dr. Stan.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. I hope you enjoyed the program. It's not nice to begin to question the integrity of people in government. But you have to understand there is a dark side to our government. There really are evil and wicked people. Most people that work for government are good people. They're doing a job. But if you stand up and you tell the truth, they're going to get you, as they did with David Graham, who worked for the FDA, who tried to tell the American people the truth about Vioxx, that probably tens of thousands, if not up to 60 or 80,000 people have died as a direct result of putting on the market a drug that they knew increased the incidence of heart attack 700%. in low doses, and they knew that in 1999. And if you adopt that, why, of course, she would be glad to send you a copy of Dr. David Graham's testimony if you call us at 1-800-544-8927. We hope many of you will want to get our video, None Dare Call It Genocide. That's None Dare Call It Genocide. Of course, we have a video on population control, because that's what it's really all about. We have a video on the four-tape set, actually, on population control, a monograph on population control. And there really are people out there who intend to kill off a large part of the world's population. You only have to read the writings of Bertrand Russell in his book, The Impact of Science on Society, who talks about the necessity for a black plague to sweep the earth once every generation so that we won't have to worry about too many people. Or Jacques Cousteau, quoted in the UNESCO Courier in November of 1991, saying we have to eliminate 350,000 people a day. It's amazing how many times I've said, we'll be glad to send you a free copy of that. People don't seem to really care. They don't want to verify it. It is true. You need to have this information. You need to help us get the truth out across America. Well, get our material. Go to our website. You can pull down our Population Control Agenda monograph from my website. It's one of the best things up there. That's the Population Control Agenda monograph. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. That's the Population Control Agenda monograph. Or, of course, if you order one of the items that we talked about, the video, None Dare Call It Genocide, Population Control, the four-tape set on population control, we'll be glad to send you a copy of that Population Control Agenda monograph. Or we hope many of you, of course, will want to get some of our newsletters. I think our November newsletter on water fluoridation and, of course, how this is being used to dumb down our children, because it does. It has a profound impact on the mind. After all, what's the active ingredient in Prozac? It's a fluoride compound. And yet they're putting fluoride in our water at levels that they don't have. We know what it does to animals. We know it knocks 10 points off the IQ of the children in China in areas that are heavily fluoridated. And what is it doing to the minds of our children? You need to get, of course, our four-tape set on water fluoridation, our four-tape set on mercury. We have two four-tape sets on water fluoridation and just the fluoride toxicity. One four-tape set on mercury, one four-tape set on NutraSweet, which does affect the brain, and all of them, of course, affect the testosterone level in males, because, of course, we want to feminize the males. It's being done. They're poisoning our people. I had a guest on this afternoon, a doctor from Phoenix, Arizona, who treats autistic children, and her remark was, we've poisoned a whole generation of our children, and I believe that's true. You need to get our material. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. We'll be glad to send you a free copy of our newsletter. Of course, go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. And, of course, you can get listen to our programs there 5 hours a day on the Internet, or go to our look at the books we have. Certainly you can look at the other things we have. We do carry the Berkey products if you're interested. And then we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival. We ask you to pray for our leaders and ministers. But please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And we'll be back in just a few minutes for the next hour. May the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But, well, hold your calls for a few minutes. We're hoping to have Joel Skousen with us. If we don't have him, why we will let you give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But we're looking forward to having Joel, editor of World Affairs Brief, talking about what's really going on in the world today, because, you know, nothing is as it appears to be. It should be very obvious to anybody who's looking at seeing what's going on in the Middle East that the United States is planning on being there for a long time. We are planning on asking for $560 million. This isn't the supplemental budget bill. Now, this is not the regular budget, but this is supplementary appropriations bill. I think they wanted $82 billion for the war in the Middle East. But a part of that was a request for $560 million to build an embassy in Baghdad. Now, do you honestly think we're going to spend $560 million if we're planning on pulling out of the Middle East in the very near future? We are building 14 major bases, military bases in Iraq. Do you honestly, in your own heart of hearts, believe we're planning on pulling out of the Middle East in the near future? Why would we be building that? I have friends in some of the other countries over there where, of course, the American bases are being built down along by the Dubai and Qatar and that area. Whole cities are going up where Americans are going to be staying. Do you really think we're planning on pulling out of the Middle East? Of course we're not planning on pulling out of the Middle East. That recent article pointed out that the Bush administration was deciding months before the 9/11 attack how we were going to divide up the oil in the Middle East. Those of you who have any question that this whole thing, this whole tragic scenario wasn't planned ahead of time, need to get the book written by Paul O'Neill, who was the Secretary of the Treasury initially when George Bush went into the White House. And the book is entitled The Price of Loyalty. And I believe it's page 96, but we can get the page for you if you'd like, where Paul O'Neill tells about going to a meeting of the National Security Council. And there is Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney. Now, this is the end of January or the 1st of February of the year 2001. And that's, what, 8 or 9 months before the 9/11 attack. And what are they talking about? Why, how we're going to go to war with Iraq. How we're going to justify a preemptive attack on Iraq. How we're going to get the American people to go along with an attack on Iraq. And how we're going to divide up the oil. And he talks about how they already had the various studies there laid out by the military. How we were going to develop up, divvy up and divide the oil that was in Iraq. Now, Paul O'Neill says, and he's sitting there, he's trying to figure out, why are we talking about going to war with Iraq? I mean, there was no reason in January, February of the year 2001 to be thinking about going to war with Iraq. But the plans were already there. If you read the book by General Wesley Clark called Winning Military Wars, I think that's the title of it. Why, of course, he tells you, he goes to the Pentagon shortly after the 9/11 attack, talks to one of his friends there, who said, why, we've been planning on this for years. We've been planning on draining the swamp over there. The war was planned long ahead of time. We just needed an excuse, and, well, we got one on 9/11. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here with Radio Liberty, and so far there's been no sign of our special guests for this hour, so we're going to certainly invite you to give us a call at 1-888 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But it is really so difficult for the average individual to imagine that there were some people in government. And I'm not suggesting the president knew what was going to happen. I think he knew something was going to happen. But I don't think he knew the details at all of what was going to happen on 911. I think he was frightened to death when actually the enormity of what had happened became obvious. But I do believe that there were some people in government who knew. And for a justification for that statement, let me suggest a book that we carry. It's called See No Evil. It's written by Robert Baer. And in the preface to that book, Robert Baer, who was a senior CIA agent in Iraq, actually, he was in Kurdistan in 1995, which was part of Iraq, although certainly it was not subject to Saddam Hussein's control. It was under Kurdish control. But certainly, as Robert Byrd said, he never ran into an Iraqi who did not believe the United States was keeping Saddam Hussein in power. And furthermore, many of the Iraqis he met believed that Saddam Hussein was actually working for the Central Intelligence Agency. And then he went on to talk about how, on several occasions, why the Iraqi military had tried to overthrow Saddam Hussein, and the American State Department had intervened and betrayed these military officers, who were then, of course, captured and tortured to death. That certainly doesn't speak very well of our State Department. But, of course, one of the things that Robert Baer brings out in his book was that a close friend of his had been told by one of the senior people at the CIA that when the dust clears after 9-1-1, the American people will realize that what happened at 9-1-1 was not a failure for American intelligence, but a triumph. When the dust clears after 9-1-1, why the American people will realize that what happened was not a failure of American intelligence, but a triumph. How could it be a triumph? There were 3,000 people dead. Well, you see, they had to get us into the war. Was there a better way to do it than what was done? The book is called See No Evil. We carry it here at Radio Liberty. You need to get the information. You need to document it. You'll find it up on my website on a number of my articles dealing with what happened on September 11th. The American people have never been told the truth, and we have to get that truth out. That's our job, right here at Radio Liberty. Well, yeah, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and we're hoping to have Joel Skousen on the line, but right now we're not, so maybe just open lines. Is this Mike from Orange County?
Yeah, it is, Stan.
Hey, how you doing?
Real good.
Are you going to come? I'm going to be speaking down there on the 4th of May there at the Freedom Forum there. Where is that? In some place in Orange County.
Oh, I'll have to find out where it's at.
Okay, fine. Well, if you need to, you can always give us a call.
Yeah.
But I want to get a good turnout. We'll be there on the 5th of May at the Granada Forum, which is up around Tarzania. But that's a long way for you to go. So, anyway, do you have a question or comment at all?
Yeah,
let me just put our 800 number out. Our 800 number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, that's 464-8295, or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. But go ahead, Mike.
Well, my question or comment was, prior to the election in 2000, there was the debate with Mr. Gore and Pat Buchanan and George Bush, and during the debate, I distinctly remember Pat Buchanan, when he was talking, he turned to him, stood there, he kind of pointed his finger at him, and he said, "In this country, we are training Saudi Arabian pilots to be terrorists with airliners."
I don't remember seeing that.
Was
Pat Buchanan in any of the presidential debates? I didn't recall he was.
This was in the 2000s.
Okay.
And this was like 10 months before 9-1-1. And I've talked to other people, they remember seeing it. I've called news media and tried to get them to look up the video, but they won't do it.
Well, of course, the CNN would have it if it's available. I've just never heard that said.
Well, I
have no question at all that we knew the attack was coming because one of the terrorists actually defected to the FBI and in April of 2000 walked into the office there in Newark, New Jersey and said, I am an Islamic terrorist. I've been trained in Pakistan, and we're going to hijack your 747s and crash them. So,
wow.
And, of course, anybody who wants that, we have that actually as Eleanor Hill's testimony before the Joint Investigation, Senate House Intelligence Committee investigation on September 18th, 2002. And we'd be glad to get any of our skeptics out there of the page from that report. You can find it on the Internet. That's Eleanor Hill's testimony, September 18th, 2002. But, you know, it's amazing what happened. The FBI just could hardly wait to get that man out of the country. They didn't try to find the rest of the hijacking cell. You would think that they would have tried to find out who the other hijackers were because he told them there were six or seven others, but he didn't. They refused to try to get them. Somebody, obviously, knew what was coming down and did not want to stop it. Have you ever seen that video entitled Jihad in America?
No.
That is one of the most amazing videos because it has this FBI footage. 1988, you'll find a fellow named Abdullah Zam. He was the founder of Al-Qaeda. He's speaking in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, about the coming jihad and spilling blood. And then, of course, they have other Islamic terrorists talking all over America. They have pictures of the Islamics training in upstate New York at rifle ranges and training with automatic weapons and firing automatic weapons in violation of all of our laws. And this is all FBI footage. They were watching this whole thing back in 1994. That video was shown one time on the public television, and then somebody is powerful enough to put out an order that was never to be shown again. It was not available in America until after 9/11. The FBI was monitoring all of the terrorists here in America. And Zacharias Massui has said that I was being watched from the moment I came into this country. That's one reason they don't want to put him on trial and try him, because he said the FBI knew everything I was doing.
Wow.
And I believe that they knew everything that the rest of the terrorists were doing as well. And they knew when the attack was coming. In fact, some of the FBI agents, frantic to get the truth out, but not wanting to risk their future, their pensions, and perhaps their lives and the lives of their family, went to a friend of mine, Dr. Garth Nicholson, and told him there was going to be an attack on the Pentagon on the 11th of September. And he reported that to high government officials who he knew. But I bet you had never heard that story any other place.
Oh, no. But it's just that I remember watching it, and it stuck in my mind. And this is like, you know, 8 or 10 months before 9/11.
I wish you could get that film footage. That would be invaluable. And I'll tell you, if anybody has it, it would be CNN. And so the thing to do would be to get hold of CNN and see if you can get it.
I've called ABC, you know, in different places.
Well, but where was the debate?
You know, I don't remember. I just remember watching the debate. You know, I'm kind of I like watching presidential elections and stuff, and I was watching it, and I distinctly remember that, and I've talked to other people. As soon as I mentioned it, they said, yeah, what was that all about? I remember that.
Well, why don't you, of course, have called Pat Buchanan's office? You can probably track him down through the Internet and ask him if he remembers where it was and what the date was, and then you can get the film. But I would just love to see the film myself.
I wonder how he got the information.
Well, why don't you give him a call and find out?
He's available, you know.
Yeah, sure. You can always track Pat down or somebody who's very close to him and get a response on that.
So, I wonder why he never mentioned it after.
Well, I don't know. You'd have to ask him. So why don't you just track it down? I would love to see that film footage.
Yeah, me too.
Anything else, Mike?
That's it.
Okay, fine. Thanks very much for calling.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, that was Mike calling from Orange County. And, of course, if you're out there, I guess we're going to have open lines because we haven't been able to track down Joel yet. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. So give us a call if you have a question or comment, you have a subject you'd like to talk about, or, you're just going to have to hear a monologue from me this evening. But certainly what is transpiring, what happened on 9/11, was a prologue to the war in the Middle East. But this is not going to be simply a very, very limited war. We're told, you know, we can't pull out. We've got a chaotic situation in Iraq. And, of course, we haven't been able to get a new government functioning there. And, of course, what they're doing is talking now about having Alawi as the prime minister. Alawi is a CIA flunky. He always has been a CIA flunky. He was appointed by the CIA. Why would the Shia Muslims and the Kurds be wanting to get Alawi? Well, obviously, why, of course, he is the person that we're putting pressure, that we want to run this, because we want to continue controlling Iraq so we can divide up the oil there. Certainly the Iraqi people don't want us to divide up their oil. They think it's their oil. But you see, they don't understand the rules of the game. The rules of the game are this. We won the war, we control the oil, and of course you're going to give it to us. So let's go to calls. We have Keith calling from Capitola. Hi, Keith. How are you doing?
Good, Doctor. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine.
Good. Yeah, your last caller mentioned, hearing Pat Buchanan talk about how
talking about, the last caller was saying that he had seen a video where Pat Buchanan had asked George Bush about the facts that the Saudis were training pilots for terrorism. Now, I never saw this, and I would certainly like to see the video before I would want to say anything at all about that. I was hoping that Mike from Orange County would try to get hold of Pat Buchanan, ask him about the information, and then get a statement from Pat, if that is really true, and we think it would be very important to have that video available. But I don't know anything more than what you just heard. Anything else, Keith?
Well, reminded me of right after the 9/11 attacks, Dianne Feinstein came on TV, and they only showed it one time. She goes, "Yeah, we've been there have been Al Qaeda training cells in the United States for years."
I have no
question. And I've been wanting to get a copy of that tape. That she's on the intelligence committee, and she comes up and goes, "Yeah, we've known that there's been Al Qaeda training cells inside the United States for years."
Well, I wouldn't all be surprised at that, but I would certainly like to get that on tape. Let me tell you though something that really is amazing. Do you ever watch 60 Minutes?
Yeah,
I watch it every week because I want to know what the enemy is doing. And of course, last night the lead-off program was somebody from Kosovo. And he was buying weapons in the United States, large numbers of weapons, lethal military weapons, and semi-automatic and automatic weapons, and shipping them to the KLA. Now, they didn't mention that the KLA is the Kosovo Liberation Army, or that the KLA is a radical leftist Al-Qaeda-backed terrorist militant group. So now this man goes on to the 60 Minutes, and he wants to tell us how liberal our laws are here, and how terrible the Second Amendment is, and how we need more gun laws to stop people like him from being able to buy weapons and ship them to Kosovo. Now, he's got unlimited money, it appears. He supposedly has a roofing company, but you don't make enough money for major gun shipments to the Middle East. Just by putting on roofs. And the second thing is, you do not go on national television and say you're violating the laws of this country by shipping weapons to militant revolutionary Al-Qaeda groups. But you saw it last night on 60 Minutes, if you watched that program. And the question is, why did they put that on? And, of course, the real reason they put it on is that they want to change our gun laws. They want to disarm the American people. And here's this man who supposedly is tied into the KLA. They did not mention it was a Al-Qaeda-backed left-wing revolutionary movement, terrorist movement. They didn't mention that, and you would think that Ben Bradley would have been smart enough to look up and see what the KLA was. But more than that, obviously Al-Qaeda wants us have more in the way of gun laws here to disarm the American people. I wonder why that would be.
Yeah.
Anything else you'd like to ask?
Same way that the Feinstein, these other people that hate guns, know that the Mexicans have been coming over the border running not only drugs, but guns over the border, automatic weapons over the border for years, and she's screaming and complaining about the Americans having the guns, but she doesn't do anything to stop the Mexicans from bringing automatic weapons over the border.
Well, of course, even more hypocrisy. I mean, this woman gives hypocrisy a bad name. When she was the mayor of San Francisco, she demanded that she be given a gun permit so she could defend herself. And when I asked her why that was, she said, well, my life was in danger. Well, I'd like to suggest that the lives of a lot of people are in danger. The lives of those kids who were killed up there at the Indian school today were in danger. And had some of the people on the faculty had a gun, this tragedy wouldn't have occurred. But what Dianne Feinstein and Barbara Boxer and the radical left have done by passing the legislation is to ensure that every one of our schools is a shooting gallery. We'll be back here in just a moment. Okay, fine. Go ahead. We missed that break, and so go right ahead. And do you have anything else you wanted to say, Keith?
You know, the your last guests were on. I was going to call and ask them, but if they heard that when the Pentagon was hit, the plane, the guided missile, whatever it was that hit the Pentagon, had to fly over a freeway and then down, you know, duck down and, you know, real low to the ground and hit the Pentagon. Well, right across the street from the Pentagon and the freeway there, there's a giant hotel there. All the rooms on that side of the hotel facing the Pentagon had been rented by the FBI.
Well, I actually talked to somebody who was in the building there, and he told me he saw the plane coming in, but it was a small plane. It wasn't a major passenger line. It was a very small plane. So, obviously, we haven't gotten the truth, and if you've seen the pictures of the hole in the side of the Pentagon,
It's
right at the ground level. Now, how were they able, of course, to get this gigantic plane, to come in exactly at ground level, and yet there'd be no scuffs on the grass right adjacent to it or on the ground?
It dropped down from 7,000 feet. It did like a 270-degree turn.
And then leveled off
at ground level, and then came straight into the thing. That's quite an acrobatic pilot for somebody that couldn't even take off or land an airplane.
And, of course, what's even more amazing than that is they just happened to hit the part of the Pentagon where the fewest number of people were working. In other words, they were repairing that section. So most of the Pentagon employees were elsewhere in the Pentagon, and it was mostly construction workers there. Wasn't that nice of the Islamic terrorists not to hit the part of the Pentagon where Donald Rumsfeld or other people were?
Yeah, especially like when you get carpenters a dime a dozen, so,
right.
You know, no big loss there.
I mean, you know, you wonder how gullible the American people are, but most of them have not really studied this issue or gone in the background of the betrayal that took place that day. Most of them have never heard the testimony that was given by Norman Mineta, who is actually in the bunker beneath the White House. We have the testimony if anybody wants to read it. And Norman Mineta is testifying before the 911 Commission. And he says, you know, Chris, I got to the White House. They were evacuating. It was about 9:15. So the Secret Service took me down to the bunker, and there was Dick Cheney. And we're sitting there, and after a few minutes, a young man comes in and says, the plane is 50 miles out. And then a few minutes later, the young man comes in and says, the plane is 30 miles out. And then the young man comes in and says, again, and says, the plane is 10 miles out. Did the orders still stand? And the vice president whipped his neck around and said, of course the orders still stand. Have you heard anything to the contrary? And somebody on the 911 commission said, well, what were the orders? And Norman Mineta said, I don't know. And you know, the most amazing thing is that nobody else ever tried to find out what those orders were.
Was the shoot down, was it Flight 93?
Well, we don't know. I mean, Flight 93 would never got, not 10 miles from Washington, D.C. So, obviously, many people think this was the plane that was coming in to hit the Pentagon. But we don't know.
You know, I've read a lot of reports and stuff, and they say that the plane that, you know, crashed out with Pennsylvania, where middle of no place, that was shot down.
Hold that.
That was the order that was given. That was the order that still.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening didn't show up, which is very unusual, because usually he's very, very, very faithful on being here, but I may have gotten him at a bad time, and he didn't mark it down in his book. Under any circumstances, with us, of course, is Keith, who's calling from Capitola. Did you have anything else to say, Keith, before we let you go?
No, that was it.
God bless him.
God bless you, too.
Okay, let's go to Jim, who's calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Dr. Stan. I just wanted to ask a question about the 9/11 issue, and I hope I'm not
backtracking from your last program. I'm sorry your guests aren't still with you from that. But, you know, I just wonder how plausible it is that some pilots, some air pilots who are half-trained can get on Boeing 757s and crash them, you know, take them off course and find a city and find buildings and crash them into these buildings at 500 miles an hour.
Well, I think it's pretty unlikely. You know, it's very, very difficult to do some of the aeronautical maneuvers that were done. And I honestly believe that it stresses credibility to believe that the story we've heard is really accurate. You remember, of course, what happened when, it was Flight 175. We saw it flying in behind the World Trade Center, and it makes this marked turn, a very, very sharp turn, and then, of course, strikes the South Tower. And exactly the same thing, of course, happened with Flight 77 that actually hit the Pentagon. It circles all the way around, does a descending spiral, and then, of course, crashes into the Pentagon. You need people who are very, very well trained to accomplish something like that.
Yeah, like stunt pilots.
Don't sign it, Joel.
No, I keep calling.
Okay. We ought to have his cell phone, but I don't know what it is.
Hello?
Okay. Oh, well, we're just talking here, hoping there's some way we can get Joel on. Yeah, I think that obviously we know that, for instance, that they have the ability to have a computer control of the planes. They're able to fly planes from San Francisco over to Australia or to Japan with nobody on board. In other words, they're all automatically controlled, something called Global Hawk. And it is a remote control system that allows them to fly planes. That's what they do with the Predator plane. And they were actually able to using those in Afghanistan before the 9/11 attack. They were tracking some of bin Laden's movements. They could pick him out because he's 6'6" tall. Towers over the adjacent Arabs. And of course, when somebody suggested we simply put a weapon into the Predator and take out Osama bin Laden, you know what they did? Why they grounded the Predators. Because the last thing we wanted to do was take out Osama bin Laden. And here's a man who's very ill. He's been on dialysis. Are we really supposed to be gullible enough to believe that now, of course, 4 years, or at least 3 years later, Osama bin Laden is in a cave somewhere in Pakistan getting regular dialysis treatments? You know, dialysis is a very, very complicated matter. You need a lot of water. You need a lot of electricity. You need a lot of sterility, or otherwise people would get septicemia and they would die. In fact, Osama bin Laden could be dead. We have no idea anything about Osama bin Laden. All we know is what the government is telling us. And, of course, recently Osama bin Laden sent a message to the American people. And in that message, it was the most amazing thing. He was talking about, of course, justifying continuing the war on America, and he mentioned that 12,000 Iraqi civilians had died. Now, those are the figures that you'll find on the CIA websites up on the Internet. But the figure that is used throughout the rest of the world is 100,000 Iraqi civilians have died. So why would Osama bin Laden use the CIA figures for the number of Iraqi casualties rather than the number commonly used and published in Lancet magazine and quoted by other people all throughout America? You have to ask yourself why he would not try to dramatize or maximize the number of Iraqi casualties. Maybe Osama bin Laden died a long time ago. We really don't know. All we know is that we keep getting these messages from him, and the CIA keeps telling us it's Osama bin Laden.
That's very interesting.
Well, so like have you ever read 1984, Jim?
Yes, I have.
And you remember Emmanuel Goldstein? He was the enemy of Big Brother.
Yeah.
Whenever they flashed his picture up on the screen, why, everybody booed. And it's sort of like what's going on with Osama bin Laden today. And every time they put his picture up on the television screen, everybody, of course, wants to boo Osama bin Laden because he's the enemy of Big Brother. I mean, he's the enemy of our current administration.
Yeah, I understand that. He's the prop-up enemy. I understand that.
Okay.
There's another issue.
All right, will you hang on? We'll get to another issue in just a minute when we get back. And well, we've got Joel Skousen. I'm afraid you're out of luck. We'll be right back in just a moment here.
We'll talk to you.
God bless. Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay. And with us on the line now from Utah is one of our favorite guests, as always, Joel Skousen, editor of World Affairs Brief. Joel, so good to have you with us.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Stan. I'm sorry for the technical problems we had getting through.
Well, anyway, we finally got you. That's the important thing. And, of course, we can always do open lines, which we did for the first half hour. So warming up people's appetite for what you're going to say. So, of course, what are we going to talk about this evening?
Well, I've got plenty on my agenda here. Any hot topics you've been talking about with your listeners that you want to address?
Oh, no. We've just actually read our first hour was with Victor Thorne on his new book, 9/11 on Trial, just going in a lot of the details of the things that you and I have covered many times before about the 9/11 attack. So why don't you talk about the things in the latest World Affairs Brief?
Well, one of the main topics, which I covered about oil prices and my prediction that as a general trend, I don't think we're ever going to see cheap gas or oil again. And one of the problems and one of my suspicions is that there has been manipulation by government of these, by oil companies in collusion with government on these prices. You know, this is relatively easy in the unstable world in which we live. There's certainly no shortage of terrorist attacks, contrived or real, that can be used to blame or to keep the oil markets unstable, and that's all it takes, apparently, to keep the price rise high. You know, I don't believe, frankly, that this is because oil has peaked. I think there are, and frankly, that discussion still is, I think, looking for an answer. I'm not saying that the world is awash in oil. I think clearly the evidence is emerging that many oil companies have overstated reserves, like Shell Oil Company has had to revise its oil reserves for the past four times now in the past year, always downward. And the Saudi fields apparently have been overproduced. One of the things we're finding is that when they use all of these high-tech injection techniques, especially water injection, it tends to ruin the field for its long-term recovery purposes. It does produce more oil by floating the oil to the surface where it can be pumped, but it does tend to destroy a field for the long-term seepage that tends to rejuvenate fields if you pull oil from it at a slower rate, which the world, of course, is not doing. But one of the things I pointed out in my brief is a telltale sign of manipulation, that is the relationship between oil prices per barrel and gas prices. You know, when this first upswing started...
Hold that thought there. Okay. For just a moment as we bring our other faces on. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and with us now is Joel Skousen, editor of World Affairs Brief, and he's talking about the oil situation, and his basic supposition is that they are manipulating the price of oil. Oil companies are in collusion with the federal government, and Joel says that the best explanation or best justification or proof that everything is manipulated is the relationship between the price of a barrel of oil and the price of a gallon of gasoline. So pick up the story there, Joel.
Well, what I was going to point out is that at the beginning of this upswing, when gas went from $1.24 a gallon to $2 a gallon, the first big really rise over 2 years ago, oil was running between $25 and $40 a barrel during that run-up, and gas prices would tweak up or down almost in near-perfect coordination with any small rise or fall in the price per barrel of oil. So everyone, you know, was being explained, well, when the price of barrel of oil goes up, then gas goes up, and when it goes down, gas goes down. This past year, however, as per barrel prices have risen from the $40 to the $55, $57 range per barrel, you know, that's a 25% increase. And yet gas prices have still been within the $1.60 to $2 range, which doesn't make any sense. You know, it was in that range at $40 a barrel. So if gas was a direct relationship, gas high prices to the price per barrel, gasoline prices should have been, you know, $3 to $4 during this price period. Now, I've heard that in Santa Monica, California, the prices did reach $3 a gallon, and they've always been higher in California than the rest of the nation, but I don't think Santa Monica is obviously representative of that. But what I'm saying is that I think there are some real, let me put it this way. I think during the first run-up, Big Oil, in collusion with government, wanted to adjust Americans' expectations on fuel prices upward. I think they discovered two things, really. One, if you slowly increase gasoline prices through various contrived mechanisms, and believe me, they have done two things which defy the markets, and that is they haven't built any new gasoline refineries, for 20 to 30 years, and they've been taking them off the line, really, which is stupid, when you're running at 99% capacity, you've got nowhere else to go if one refinery catches on fire as it did in California. Why, with gas prices so high, aren't you building new refineries? And secondly, you're not building any new tankers, so you've got these two big bottlenecks. Doesn't matter how much oil you pump, you can't ship it fast enough, and you can't refine it fast enough in order to... And for some reason or another, they're not responding to the market mechanisms as they normally would. That, to me, is manipulation. But the other evidence that I was talking about is that they knew that you had to, in order to not get a backlash on high oil prices, you have to run prices up to a certain level and let them stabilize and drop a little bit. And then people think, after they went to $2 a gallon, they settled back down into the $1.75, $1.80 range. Everyone was saying, oh, good, cheap gas again. Failing to realize this wasn't cheap gas. $1.24 was cheap gas. And now people have gotten used to seeing $1.75, $1.80 as something that's cheap. Now they're running it up past $2, and people are going to look back a year from now and say, oh, remember the good old days of $2 a gallon gas? So people's, mindset does change as they, and I notice this happening to myself, saying to myself, oh, look, there's some cheap gas at $1.69, and yet 2 years ago I would have thought that was outrageous.
It's all a matter of perception, isn't it?
Well, it is. But what's happened is this, I think. Americans have been used to cheap gasoline for so long that they build an entire lifestyle around cheap gas. In Europe, you don't find people, commuting very far to work because gasoline is $7.50, $8 a gallon. But here, because gas has been so cheap for so long, people commute very long distance to work. They live far away in suburbia. They don't patronize public transportation. Public transportation has never developed to the extent that it has in Europe because of high gas prices. So these are structural changes actually locked into our society, and it will take generations of hardship to change those. People will have to move closer to work, and unfortunately, and I'm not a big fan of urbanization, while, there are some economies of efficiency when everybody lives very close to where they work, no one is self-sufficient in a high-density urban area. Everyone is highly dependent on government. And it's very much easier for government to manipulate people and make them dependent.
But don't you think, Joel, that is exactly what the plan is? Don't you think that this is really what they want, is to drive the prices of oil gradually upward to get us out of our cars, to force us into the urban environment, into so-called sustainable communities?
Yeah, I think that there is an agenda with some of the people higher up, just as there's an agenda in this illegal alien invasion that's been allowed by our government. No matter what they say, they continue to open the borders, and I think they're trying to water down our political and cultural entities here. And these are things which are, I'm afraid, with us because, we really don't have much choice. We have developed a system of absolute dependency on oil, and it's very, very difficult to get around that. I do recommend that people, though, because I'm predicting now that gasoline, and in fact certain experts have said, there really isn't any resistance at $2 a gallon, and that's what's interesting, is prices have doubled in gasoline, and people are still not changing their driving habits. And experts don't believe that they'll change until gasoline gets up into the $3 to $4 a gallon range, and then it'll start to impact first the poor, and then the middle class.
And I think people have to understand that in Europe, those prices are up at about $6 a gallon. I've been told that recently prices were even higher than that in Great Britain. So, we've been living in a fool's paradise here, and I think the time of reckoning is going to come, is coming right now.
Well, and that's why people need to economize now, prepare for the rush. it's going to be very difficult to get a high mileage car someday, you know, when gasoline gets up to $4 a gallon. You know, the hybrid cars, which are marvelous pieces of engineering, are great machines, but I'm predicting that they'll be very costly to repair down the road. They're too high tech for individuals to repair themselves. So I'm recommending people stick with the proven line of VW diesel TDI engines. The TDI is a 45 to 50 mile per gallon engine, and you know, not that complicated. It's so I'm predicting that's going to be the best deal, you know, for people to work through.
And do they have those in full size cars, or they? I remember we used to have them in the small Volkswagen.
Well, Volkswagen diesel. Has always used them in their high economy. Jettas and Passats, so the Passat's you know, a medium-sized car. But interesting enough, VW is licensing this TDI technology to almost every other car manufacturer, and we're going to see in the next 2 years everyone from GM to Ford coming out with VW-style TDI diesel engines. So the world is changing in that regard.
And, of course, then you're talking about 45 a gallon.
That's right.
Oh. Right.
That's right. And you see, the hybrid cars only get, 55 or so. So it's pretty close to the hybrid without the expense. And the hybrids are very small vehicles. I'm predicting, you know, like in Europe, you know, they have TDI diesels in V8, V12, V10. I mean, big diesels that they don't get 45 to 50 miles a gallon, but that they still get a lot more than what our gasoline engines do. But there just hasn't been the market for diesels here because, the American diesel is typical of the diesel trucks that you see, the pickup trucks, you know, loud, rattly, powerful diesel engines, smoke quite a bit. They're a different animal than these TDI engines out of Europe. They don't have the raw power that the American diesels do, but they sure have the economy, and they're quieter.
Well, now, one of the things here in California, they're talking about putting hydrogen stations all along our freeways, and they hope within, 10 years to have, you know, hydrogen stations every 20 miles along our freeways. What do you think? Is there a future for hydrogen cars, or is this all simply hype?
Well, no, hydrogen, you know, is a very workable technology, but it's expensive. There's just no way, I think, the hydrogen engine obviously is not much different than the gasoline engine, but that's what makes it simple. But it's getting the hydrogen economically into a fuel state and then pumping it and storing it in a vehicle because of the very high pressures that you have to use with it. So you either have this technology where you convert hydrogen from fuel within the vehicle, manufacture your own, so that's very costly. Or you have it, with stations, and you fill it up, and even then that's costly in the storage, and there's some danger involved in the high pressures that you have. So, I still don't see that as, in terms of economies of scale, of anything near close to what is available right now with the TDI turbo diesel injection engines that are quiet, have as much zip as a gasoline car, and have been available and have a proven track record. But Americans government's going to continue to throw money at the big corporations to come up with something in the hydrogen vehicle area, and I'm afraid it's, as with many of the things that we talk about in progress in life, our society can only absorb progress for so long when corruption and conspiracy seizes government and wars come. That's what kills progress for many years. It's, not our inventiveness, the ability of the free market to continue. It's the lack of moral stability in the world that allows for these benefits to life to continue. So I'm not optimistic because of the increased corruption in the world and the increased evidence of conspiracy among government to take away liberty that we're going to have the freedoms available to continue to take advantage of the high productivity in the marketplace.
Well, because my concern right now is what's happening to the value of our dollar. It's quite obvious that we're going to progressively continue losing value of the dollar as long as we have massive trade deficits, as long as we have massive government deficits, as long as we continue the spending binge we're on, and then as long as the government provides something for everybody that we possibly in no way can afford. And well, I think that probably one of the greatest threats to our survival is a monetary threat. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, governments never, nations never fall because of economics. They deteriorate to a point where they get conquered militarily, and they get corrupt. But economically, people, even in the Soviet Union, you never did fall economically. They went to a subsistence level economy where people just lived hand to mouth. But they continued to survive, and people usually don't go below that level. It's amazing how many years they lived at that subsistence level with the West rising all around them, and there's nothing they could do because they had no arms, they had no way to resist the powers that were restricting them. But in the West, when you have economic corruption, as you did in the 20s, when you lost moral values, etc., and that came along, and war followed afterward, and it was war that was the major threat. And that's what I see today is, you know, these illusions of peace and prosperity dumb down the American people, keep them feeling as if everything is fine. They fail to be observant that there are predator nations building against the United States, that our continual antagonism around the world is going to breed a retribution, a retaliation in the United States that will mean a world war. We're going to be targeted, in my opinion. But you know, economically, Dr. Stan, as you are absolutely correct, the dollar will continue to fall, but it will be gradual. The reason it will be gradual, there's so many people with vested interest that have to keep the dollar up. First of all, those central banks that have billions of dollars in the vaults can't start to get rid of it. If they even get rid of a quarter to a half of what they've got, the markets fall so precipitously, they lose billions in value before they can liquidate the rest of their dollars. So they have a vested interest in keeping the dollar stable by slowly starting to switch into other currencies. And those other currencies can't absorb all of the value of the dollar at the present time. There aren't enough euros around to even supplant a quarter of the U.S. dollars around in the world. China has a vested interest in keeping the American economy strong enough to consume its goods. So does Japan. So do Europe, France, and Germany. Nobody wants to see the dollar fall. And so the U.S. knows this. And that's why I think they're taking advantage of the fact and not only inflating, creating money and credit, but deficit spending with abandon. One of the reasons is politically. They know that they have to buy benefits through welfare spending to keep the votes coming. Republicans do it as bad as the Democrats used to now. But worse yet, they don't want the American people to get tired or to have to pay a price for these wars of intervention, and that's why they use deficit spending. They don't give anybody a tax bill for these things. And because of that, people don't feel the pain.
And I think that's really so true. What we're doing is borrowing the money so that we can fight the wars, because, of course, if the people had to pay for the wars and with massive increased taxes, why, people would rise up and say, we don't want to be going to war.
That's right. If they were getting a bill of $1,000 to $2,000 a year per person, boy, I'll tell you, this war would be very unpopular very quickly.
Right, and that's exactly what they did with Vietnam. That's what, of course, when they just took the Social Security fund and put it in into the regular budget so they could fund the war out of the proceeds that should be used for paying Social Security down the line. Instead, we spent that on the weapons that were used to kill people and, of course, to maintain the war in Vietnam for a decade.
That's right. You know, there's another top story that hit my website. As you know, my researchers post many of the top stories each day on worldaffairsbrief.com. And Judicial Watch, as you know, has always been after the Justice Department to prosecute wrongdoing in government. Now, this is under the Bush administration. The Judicial Watch made its fame by battling the Clinton administration. Now we have the Bush White House has been fighting Judicial Watch for years, who has been trying to subpoena through the Freedom of Information Act, documents related to Clinton's pardons. You know, he pardoned some real criminals like Mark Rich and Pincus Green, who helped set up these nefarious secret bank accounts for Yasser Arafat and other people who the U.S. was buying off. And now the Bush administration has finally relinquished the documents. According to a court order, they were resisting it, and it's all blacked out except for two things. They will tell who the memos were sent to, who they were being received, but virtually everything in 915 pages is blacked out. I mean, talk about flaunting the intent of the Freedom of Information Act. They just simply are saying, we're complying with a court order and we're not telling you anything. And the courts are letting them get away with this.
Well, I think, of course, the thing is that most conservatives think that Bill Clinton was bad and the Republicans are good. And I think that the lesson to be learned is both sides are corrupt. And, of course, I think that the Clinton administration certainly was transferring our technology to communist China. But so is the Bush administration. We're just agreeing to guarantee a $5 billion loan for the Export-Import Bank for communist China so they can build up their nuclear energy industry. Well, what sort of madness is this? I think people one of these days are going to have to learn. We have a one-party system in America. It has two branches. One of those branches are Republicans. The other branch is the Democrats. We'll be right back here with Joel Skousen here at Radio Liberty. Well, Joel, we got 3 minutes, so what should we talk about?
Well, the important lesson about this is that this should dispel any illusions among the conservatives that this Bush administration is on our side. When this Bush administration covers for the Clinton White House, and use invoke their special exemptors under the Freedom of Information Act, saying that the deletions were for reasons of internal deliberations of government and contain personal information, and therefore they can't be made public. This is just ludicrous. When you read through the list of these 140 people that Clinton pardoned, these were people, many of them came from Arkansas, who were criminals, who were involved in drug dealing down in Arkansas. And what that really tells you is, of course, Clinton was the grand master of all the drug deals. He was covering for the main Arkansas drug deals. Well, he was getting a cut of $1 million a year, which was going into a Swiss bank account. And some of those people who had knowledge of Clinton's dealings in that got put into prison, and these were payoffs for these people for getting them out of prison. And, the list of these 140 people is just a list of sleaze. And for the President of the United States to be pardoning these people, to even being considering that these people deserve, when there are hundreds of people who are sitting on, in prison for unjust reasons, where government has been excessive and persecuting people, and none of those can get a pardon, but sleazy criminals can get a pardon from Clinton, and the Bush administration is covering for those pardons because they're working for the same system that Clinton does.
Well, of course, I think the most interesting thing is that Mark Rich's ex-wife gave, a couple of $100,000 to one of the Clinton foundations, or maybe the Clinton Library Foundation. I mean, it was a massive financial gift, and then immediately Bill Clinton pardons her husband. Does anybody think that's a payoff? And if they don't, why, of course, there's something wrong with them.
But actually, it wasn't a payoff. In my estimation, that story was a cover story to divert the public from the real story, and that is the relationship of Rich and Pinkus Green, both partners in setting up illicit bank accounts. They're the ones who helped set up Clinton's bank accounts. They're the ones who set up Yasser Arafat's bank accounts. They're the ones who helped launder all of the criminals around the world who are working in tandem with globalist government for these payoffs to keep people in line. That's why they were really pardoned, and they're deeply involved with the corrupt government of Israel, who had a hand in, believe it or not, setting up Yasser Arafat's bank accounts.
Now, things are never as they appear to be, are they? We'll be right back with Joel. Well, Joel, the half hour has gone so quickly, but I want you to get out your telephone number and your website so people will know how to get your publication if they'd like to, how they can get their hands on the World Affairs Brief.
Well, the World Affairs Brief is my weekly news analysis where I add my insights into what I think are the ulterior motives between what is done in the world. And it's available by going to worldaffairsbrief.com. People can subscribe right online. All of the daily news stories are free of charge, of course. You can read the news every day on World Affairs Brief. And if you don't have access to the web, you can call toll-free 877-518-5888 and get a free copy of the current edition of the World Affairs Brief and the print edition.
All right, now I certainly go to World Affairs Brief first thing in every morning. Fascinating information. Yeah, it keeps me from having to go to a number of other websites. Everything I want is right there. God bless you, Joel. Thank you so very much for being with us.
My pleasure, Dr.
Good night. Bye-bye. All right, fine. Well, that was Joel Skousen, and I hope you enjoy it. I always enjoy Joel and getting his take on what's going on, because it's always just a little different than conventional wisdom. But, of course, I think Joel has a great deal of wisdom and a great deal of insight, and certainly his background in the military and his background in intelligence gives us the benefit of his connections around the world that will give you an entirely different slant on what's going on. But I think far closer to the truth than you're ever going to get from Dan Rather, although Dan isn't going to be there anymore, but from a CBS, ABC, and NBC, all of which are part and controlled by the media elite. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we certainly hope that many of you will want to begin to understand what's really going on in the world, because you're not being told the truth. If you have not yet read the book, The New Media Elite, by Professor Ben Dackey, and this is the seventh edition of his book, it is available from Radio Liberty. Fascinating reading, taking you into the five mega corporations that dominate the American media. If you don't know about the secret societies, you need to read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and of course you can get it by itself, or with a video and the audio tape. That's the Brotherhood of Darkness special. If you'd like to hear my talks on the secret societies, why, of course, you can get the four-tape set on the secret government with an interview with Professor Carol Quigley. Or you can get the four-tape set on secret societies. It includes my talk on the Brotherhood of Darkness and other information you're just not going to get elsewhere. Cecil Rhodes' secret society we go into. This information you're not going to get any other place. We hope that you'll want to go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. And, of course, remember, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927, and you can go to our website, you can listen to our programs on the internet 5 hours a day, either at that website or at the other websites we link to, because we do 5 hours a day. And then, of course, you can listen to our archive programs. You can begin to get an overview of what's going on. And if you want the documentation for anything we talk about, you give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. We can usually lay our hands on the documentation for just about everything we say. Understand that we are involved in a spiritual battle that's being played out on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield. And the enemy, of course, is not communism, although communism is part of the problem. The enemy is not the Masons, or the enemy is not certainly the current administration or Bill Clinton. They are simply symptoms of a much deeper illness. Because the presidents are usually simply figureheads for the power elite that works behind the scenes. And behind them, the secret societies that have a goal. A new world order. A new world religion. This is covered certainly in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and so many of the other books we carry. Ted Flynn's wonderful book, The Hope of the Wicked, we recommend. So go to our website, RadioLiberty.com, if you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, maybe the November newsletter that goes into how they're poisoning our children with fluoride. Just give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, and then pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and ministers, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Until tomorrow, at the same time. Dr. Stan, good night. May the Lord be with you.